So I'd like to start, preface this class with asking us all to arouse bodhicitta, so that when we study this material, we are actually dedicating the merit and the goodness that comes from exploring the Dharma and learning from it, so that this can go towards a greater good, going towards benefiting beings and assisting everyone to achieve enlightenment and liberation. So, all right. Did everyone have a chance to look at the book material?
How far are we supposed to get to this week, Mike?
100.
Oh my God, I can't imagine.
Well, I don't know. I missed last week, and I don't know how many people began. We went into the innocent question. Was that covered?
No.
Okay, so.
But Michael's covered it before.
Yeah, well, I'll just write it summary. So we have a follow through. Shariputra is asking this question. So, you know, we call him Venerable Shariputra. Does anybody know why?
Because he asked a question.
No, that doesn't make him a venerable person.
Well, I mean, it may make him now, but when we talk about...
He was called venerable in his own day. And if you'll notice, there are certain Buddhist practitioners whose names start with venerable. By the way, this is Michael Levin, a latecomer, just so you'll, everybody knows.
was there something about whether he was a bodhisattva or not?
No. The venerable means basically you have been working on yourself through the Hinayana path. That's actually the basis. You've studied the Dharma, you've practiced, learned, contemplated, and meditated, and you've achieved some basic understanding of Dharma. You understand about the basic teachings, that is to say, you understand and practice with, you know, an understanding and engagement about the Four Noble Truths and all of the things that that implies. So that's important because he was already part of this crew. He didn't just wander in from off the street. He's been part of the Buddha's entourage, as it were.
And he had the title Arhat.
Arhat, yes. So, but, you know, because a person is called venerable doesn't necessarily mean he's an Arhat, but it is an honorific term to describe someone who's dedicated their life to the Dharma. And his basic question was fundamentally how we actually engage on this path. Now, we've been studying Mahayana for now about 2.5 years. Sir, may I ask you, are you acquainted with Mahayana teachings?
No.
Okay. All right. So just please go along with what we're doing. we've been looking at, to just briefly review, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, and basically, which is, as Carl Brunhild so says, Heart Attack Sutra, because it didn't merely give the Arhats who were present and those people who thought they understood Dharma enough to asphyxiate and have severe angina or other problems, but also basically because it's so shocking and so fresh and so immediate and so pertinent. And so the main thing that we've been talking about in terms of what it means to work with this material, with understanding emptiness, is that it's going to basically help us lighten up, open, relax, untie these knots that we have on ourselves, and as Trungpa Rinpoche was fond of saying, give up hope. We have to be hopeless. Now, what does that mean? Anybody guess? Go ahead.
In one of Pema Chodron's books, the one about Lojong, that she's abandoned any hope of fruition. That it's when we're sitting there and we're doing this because we have this goal, this will happen. Because I do this, I will become some particular thing. That's not going to happen.
We've also given up hope about that there's no end to samsara, yeah. That there's no light at the end of the tunnel that's suddenly going to deliver us,
right.
Or anybody. It's relentless and it's continuous. So it's utterly hopeless.
If we have hope, we're living in the future.
Hmm?
Is it because if we have hope and we're thinking about, you know, where we're going to get?
Well, where are we when we hope? We're just hoping we're somewhere other than here.
Right.
We're hoping things are going to be other than they seem to be, or wishing they will be. We're not really here and now when we hope for anything, actually, are we? And what are we hoping? Where does this hope come from? You know, hope is coming from our unwillingness to surrender, to simply being completely now.
Hope comes from the fear.
That's right.
It's the other side of the coin.
The other side of...
They're together. They're doing this dance, hope and fear. And they're based on each other.
Right.
They base their whole world on each other. So, it really means going beyond that is really what it means.
You can't be a fearless warrior if all you have is hope.
That's true. You have to give up hope to be fearless.
Still me? Yeah, but couldn't you just be optimistic?
What?
Couldn't you just be optimistic?
Optimistic?
Yeah.
You can be optimistic. I mean, you know, there are temperaments. We're not going to say you have to be a certain temperament. There are optimistic and pessimistic temperaments, right? I mean, we can't... Nobody's going to force you to be somebody who you aren't. If you're optimistic by nature, that's great. If you're pessimistic...
That leads to hope. Right?
Not necessarily at all. You're just open. And cheerful.
Right?
Optimism is basically, from this point of view, cheerful about accepting the present. What is here is enough to work with.
What did you say?
Seeing something good.
Your stars.
I said it's not to be goal-oriented.
We're not talking, yes, absolutely not goal-oriented. So if we look at the Hinayana, actually, just to reminder about something, Conor Rinpoche said it wonderfully a few years ago, the chief marks of a Hinayana practitioner, when they actually are fully engaged, is simplicity, silence, and renunciation. You're already giving up. You're abandoning all of your fixations and, you know, personal cozy spots and desires to basically constantly make things comfortable and have a pleasant outcome. You're willing to actually lean in to this unknown. But, you know, your perspective is a bit limited because it's fundamentally about working it out for yourself. Here we're talking about finding ways to disengage from that and learn what is actually in front of us already. And it's been here forever and we just never notice because it is so simple. It is so easy. It doesn't require effort. This is the radical shift. So, that's just a preface a little bit to, trying to understand the answer to his question was,
son or daughter
of noble family, which means a person who's committed to this path as a bodhisattva, who's taken, you don't have to be formally taking vows to do this, but you're a person who really actually understands the nature of reality as completely open and beyond the grasp of mind and fundamentally positive. So from that point of view, it's not optimism in the sense of, because there are plenty of practitioners who really are bodhisattvas and they are pessimistic, I can tell you. But, you know, you actually understand that the reality of things is ultimately positive. It's ultimately, and as a result, you're not at war with samsara. Because you realize that samsara and nirvana are just basically come together as a duality. And so what we're learning about is going beyond that kind of dualistic orientation of trying to get from point A to point B, or looking at somehow wanting to be on the other end of the spectrum. You're still part of that spectrum, so you're never going to avoid the other end of it, no matter what, right? I mean, this is actually rather profound in terms of, we talk about what happens when we talk about samsara and nirvana. We're talking about nirvana can't exist without samsara, right? Because they define each other, right?
What?
It's freedom from, right?
Freedom from, but we're already thinking about from, therefore we have either an antagonist or some other kind of undesirable situation. So, yeah, so anyway, what do we do? Well, how does a person of noble family trained who wishes to practice prajna parami? He's already getting this message that you got to practice the prajna. He's heard the teachings about the five, the six perfections, the six paramitas, and he's saying, well, how do we do this? So Avalokiteshvara is answering to say, basically, we start looking at what we think is our big problem about our skandhas, right? That's part of the teachings of the fundamental core teachings of ego structure, skandhas. And so, basically, we view them or we recognize them to be like kind of empty, like transparent, like hot air balloons that we can actually see through. So that's a shift, isn't it? Instead of just viewing it as being sort of caught up in some kind of a cage, you know, where you're just turning in circles. And previously we steeped ourselves in study and examining and ascertaining the role of skandhas, and here we're learning that these are just five balloons inflated by ego, empty of content. In other words, that's what happens when we actually look at our thoughts. We do this in our meditation practice, first of all. We can't go out and start to examine the nature of phenomena until we, first of all, have to go inside and look at the nature of what is perceiving the phenomena and what's interpreting it. Right? Who's that?
Watcher.
So that's me, you know. I mean, I'm the one who creates this phenomena. I'm the one who creates my perceptions. And so we're starting to learn about just look. When we look at that, when we look, for instance, in the Hinayana practice, just even looking for this so-called self, we can't find it, right? I mean, this is a real, true, something we can ascertain for ourselves. This is not some big secret. This is actually direct. We have to do this with our direct insight. So this is baby prajna, we could say, first of all, because we're getting that direct insight into nobody there. Mm-hmm. Now, if nobody's convinced that this is the case in this room, I suggest making an appointment to go on a retreat, a meditation retreat, and spending about at least a few weeks in meditation practice, and see if you can find this so-called self. Because if you can actually come to a determination for yourself that there's nobody there, it's going to be a huge relief in itself. And it'll be a lot easier to understand that everything that we think we're made up of is equally can't be found. This is what we're talking about. So this is like, he's describing it as hollowness, which is a fine, perfect way of doing it, as kind of like a balloon. And to see it is actually pop it. To basically puncture it. Just see it alone. We don't do anything. This is the primordial, fundamental key tenet of Buddhist practice, is not doing anything. It's very profound, because actually, nothing actually happens in the context of emptiness, and we relax into that space. So I encourage everyone to explore this. Test it. Check it out. You have to find out whether this works or not for you. We're not just talking about a theory. We're talking about something that we can actually do. Am I talking like down to anybody? Do you feel like I'm... Okay, I mean, because I just want to like really go through this clearly and make sure we understand how we can do this.
Yeah, people should feel free to challenge
absolutely.
Questions.
You have questions or observations.
Don't
who
hold
do you
back.
Think you are?
Ask your questions. Be sure to let it out.
Okay, seeing illusion as illusion doesn't make it go away.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, we are aware that it is unreal. Now, so
that's profound.
Yeah, that's really great.
And I was just going to say that doesn't make any sense.
Okay, well then, that's why it's profound.
What is illusion as illusion? It's basically recognizing what we've been taking seriously as solid, you know, actually is kind of just sort of something that is just impermanent. It's all impermanent. Everything is continuously in a state of flux. We've been studying this from the very beginning of our exploration. Yes?
I think it was in this analogy, because I've been reading a couple of different texts on this. They said, you talked about the illusionist's show, the magic
right,
show.
Yeah,
I love that one.
Where David Copperfield.
David Copperfield.
Page, yeah,
imagine
90.
You're sitting in the audience and you're watching an illusion and you buy into it and you're like, wow. And for a moment, your brain actually thinks, he really did that. But then if you know the trick and you can see it for what it is, you're just like, uh-huh. You know, you're not moved by it. You're not buying it.
You can be moved. I mean, it's okay if you listen to music. It's illusion.
Yeah.
If you go to a movie, you
but
get
you
very
know
engaged.
That you know that it's
you get very
not
choked
real.
Up about
yeah.
If something's very effective, it can really powerfully affect you. But it's still illusion.
Right.
And so seeing that it's illusion is then recognizing that I'm not going to have to carry this out once I've had my experience. And it could be cathartic. I mean, we're not saying anything's wrong with this happening. You're not stuck with it and making it informing you about having to like then sort of structure your life and your experience and perceptions around that as a result. So that's very important. In other words, we're talking about learning how, as we explore and examine the nature of our experience and the way our minds work, we start to dehypnotize, because we've been hypnotized, we've been in a deep hypnosis all the time, and we keep doing it all the time. And as we learn how to loosen that up and denarcotize, as it were, or, you know, simply we're learning how to be free. And so this is all starts with our thoughts and our interpretations of what we see and experience. So then the next thing is we're learning how to train to relax in an awakened state. Because we're talking about awareness as being the key factor here. How do we do that? Anybody have any ideas?
Well, first you have to relax. First you just have to relax.
Yes. Well, is that all you have to do?
Without the awakened state.
But is that all you need to do? Relax?
I'm saying first.
Yeah, well, I think that the relaxation can come when we realize there's nothing, and we begin to realize that there's nothing to get worked up about.
That's it.
There's no intrinsic nature.
Well, that's the thing. When we look for the nature, so we have this thing called, I mentioned it before, in Tibetan the term is Jungne Drosum, and it means arising, dwelling, ceasing, the three. And you're just saying, basically, where does any thought arise? Where does it dwell? Where does it cease? What is the color? What is the shape? What is the texture? What does it feel like? You know, as you begin to ask yourself these questions, everything starts to switch and change. What was completely, you know, totally spellbinding you 5 minutes ago, suddenly it's like loosening up, and there's some room, some holes are popped in the walls, and you're seeing through maybe some daylight coming through this dark room or whatever color you happen to be in, because you could be also totally absorbed and fascinated by this thing as well. So we're looking at actually just learning how to loosen up. And so, yes, loosening up, but there's a lot of discipline with this loosening up. So relaxation alone isn't the answer, because, you know, otherwise this would have been taken care of eons ago by people who had mastered the art of relaxation, right?
I wonder if we can think of an example of people have some ideas of bringing that out in terms of an experience.
So you mean like
how to relax, like how you can, how this helps you in your life to see things as more illusionary or not so solid, and then there from that there's a sense of relaxation. How does that really?
Well, definitely with emotions. If you can stop feeding the emotion with a story and just let yourself be there with the feeling itself without feeding it, it's only a matter of a few minutes before it starts to settle down into something that's not so big and powerful. Mm-hmm. Pema Chodron used a term which, if I remember, was like aerated or something like that. Perforated or aerated.
Poke holes in it.
Yeah.
Ventilate.
That's the word she used. Yeah. Ventilating it until it just starts to get softer and starts to dissolve more.
Well, and you can actually just go and experience the poignancy of that taste, and then when there's nothing attached to it, it can be relieved and move on. Right. They're going to be, because the mind and the situation is continuously changing.
Well, I think also some of the ones where they talk about, like, you could look at something and at the first glance it might look like a snake.
Mm.
Then you realize it's not. And when you can start to realize there's so many ways in which you look at a situation and you may have this whole story about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look again and you realize, no, that's not, like, I'm making these stories, they're not real.
Mm-hmm.
That's having an emotional reaction.
Having an emotional reaction and having a mind sort of looking for that when that's not happening, and you can let go of that sort of anxiety that comes because you're always looking for what's dangerous, and you say, no, it's actually right here, right now, it's pretty safe.
What was that story about the rope, the monk who stayed up all night thinking that the rope in the corner of the room was a snake? And it wasn't until dawn came that he realized it was just a rope, and that's when he became enlightened.
Yeah,
right. That's what he wanted.
But sometimes it is a snake, and you just have to go with the snake, and if it bites
you've got to work with the situation.
With that. Mm-hmm. I mean, something like that came up for me this week that was potentially something at work that could have not been good. And I thought about it from a Buddhist point of view. It's like, we're just relaxing that, and then, but all the other people around you are not looking at things like that. And this could have serious ramifications in a real, very real sense.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, then you just have to go with it and not get so worked up about it.
Well, you have a lot more flexibility.
If something bad comes from that, so bad or something,
it may be a painful lesson.
Yeah,
it may be something one needs to
and
know.
And that's what it came.
If you've got an infection in your, you know, in your leg or something, and you're not paying any attention, you need to look at it and actually allow it to open when you actually and see the festering. You can't just sort of assume it's not really there.
That's not what we're talking about. It's not a snake. It's like, it could be a snake and it's going to bite you.
We're talking about misinterpreting things when we say rope. Mistaking us for a snake.
Yeah.
We're not saying when a snake's there, we say it's a snake.
What I'm getting at is the tendency that I have, probably many of us do, is sometimes we're using the path to try to calm ourselves down so we can feel better about that.
And guess what?
And that's the goal. I'm on this so I can feel better about this.
What do you do if you see that? What do you do if you actually notice that there's this grasping creature back there?
I was thinking in meditation, I've got to talk to Emily about that some more.
Oh no, go see someone else.
Khandra Rinpoche has a talk that I'm doing right now of the competition versus compassion.
Mm.
And she talks about using compassion to run away from the pain.
Uh-huh.
So it was a really good talk about that.
Well, Trungpa Rinpoche talked about this too, about also using Tonglen and those practices as a means of spacing out and avoiding actually dealing with what really, really has to be addressed.
Right.
So one of the things that you could consider and we actually learn about as we lean into and explore and get more familiar with, even though we can't conceive of what it is, we can't really define it conceptually, emptiness, we can say something about it. It's very ordinary because it's everywhere and in everything.
Mm.
It's ordinary and profound at the same time. And that ordinariness is part of the leveling kind of thing that happens. Where, what's the big deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing's there. Okay, well, all right, onward. So it's really ordinary. It's just, we're still here. You know, I mean, this huge nightmare that we were dreaming up 10 minutes ago suddenly has popped. And, we're all just here and somewhat bored. wondering what can we cook up now, right?
Is that that cool boredom that Trungpa Rinpoche would talk about in meditation?
Well, that's more of an earlier kind of issue, I mean, if I could say that, because when we talk about cool boredom, we're talking about something that just simply stops trying. The hot boredom is trying to escape and constantly fill up space and just give ourselves more to get distracted from. That's cool boredom is the willingness to just drop it. Mm-hmm. So we start that much earlier on. We start that in basic meditation instruction. We don't start talking about emptiness of phenomena. And, you know, we're talking now on a level of... And we're going to find out why we do this. This is really, really important. That's why I asked you that we all could arouse bodhicitta before we start this discussion and exploration together. Because really, this is the key point, is remember, this is not an intellectual kind of dueling or club for, you know, getting on top of everything and sitting over and understanding everything, omniscience. It's all about really openness and compassion, and realizing that openness and compassion, this softness, this vulnerability is actually our true nature. It's like, and we only can really actually, conscientiously, it can happen accidentally, and it does a lot, but at the same time, we can actually learn how to train in this. Train in being vulnerable. Train in being soft. Train in being flexible. Yeah. This comes along with that. It's not like we're just pinned against the wall. It's like you discover if everything is completely open, then we're not only dealing with three options in a situation necessarily. There might be an infinite number of other possibilities that if we just stay open might somehow come in and sort of erase that particular fixation we had. And that's a really important consideration when you think it's either or. You know, life or death. Either I blow my brains out, or else I go off and let somebody else do it. You know. So, okay, what is emptiness? And basically, nobody's going to tell you what it is. So, because you can't. That's the issue. It's beyond the grasp of mind. And so, we can talk about what it isn't. You know, that's much easier. We can talk about that and to help hone, make us understand we're not going there. We don't have to sort of like think it's associated with any particular thing. It's not analysis. It's not only empty when we see it. It's already there. It's already present. It's not the object of meditation. We can't meditate on emptiness. Sometimes you'll hear that term, but it's a complete impossibility. What are you going to meditate on?
We don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can't. I mean, you could. Your mind can stop, but you're not meditating on anything at that point, right? So, you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's easier for me to understand impermanence, I think, than it is emptiness.
Same thing.
But it's not there yet.
It's an aspect of emptiness.
The
impermanence is the first aspect, the easiest possibly way of understanding. Nothing is staying put. Everything is constantly in a state of flux.
Mm-hmm. So you asked earlier, what can we do? And it seems to me that for me, not to speak for anybody else, but for me it's being really in the moment and not bringing the past with me and not being afraid or whatever, looking to the future to escape what's now. And that's a simplicity. There's a simplicity in that.
And so how do you train to do that?
Constant reminder, I think. Sort of a, you know, pinching yourself to kind of say, be here now, that kind of thing.
You think meditation has anything to do with it?
Well, absolutely, but I think if you can do that whether you're working or whether you're, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can carry that with you. It doesn't have to be a
thing. Yeah, one of the consequences of meditation practice is that we start to punch holes in our habitual thinking and our chain link of association, so that there's more room coming in, and you know, so that does give us a little more room. We can stop and like, oh, wait a minute, you know, it's not like I just have to go with this particular thought that's coming into my head. And so as we learn how to practice and get more familiar with the meditation practice itself, learn about the vapidity of our thoughts, the insubstantiality of our thoughts, right? That actually, it's much easier to drop them. And it's much easier not to get caught up. It doesn't mean it won't happen. It doesn't mean things won't come up. They will, absolutely. And there's going to be all kinds of situations that even trigger them more powerfully once you sort of let down all these very elaborate defense systems we have to, you know, keep ourselves comfortable.
But when you say meditation, it's also the active practice in the world I think you're referring to, too. Like, yeah, during the day, remembering, be here now or be present, that moment-by-moment awareness. So it's beyond meditation on the cushion, is training to be awake in the world. So I think it is important to stress that, too.
Yeah. For me, I think the benefit of retreat is it gives you an opportunity, yeah, being in the world, you know, you have to practice with others and there's a lot of variables, but when you're sitting with yourself, it simplifies it down so much,
yeah,
that the distraction is you.
Right.
And you see that so clearly. It's not about, you know, other, I mean, you can make it about other people, you can make it about other meditators that are there with you, or yeah, the food or whatever or the cushion, yeah, or whatever you want, but you start to see that much more clearly.
Yes. Yeah.
You're facing the mirror, and that's what I found was really helpful about retreats and sitting for long periods of time.
Good.
Megan, you had something?
I actually, you hit the nail on the head. I was going to say, not quite so beautifully, the same thing. But on top of that, it's easy for me to try to talk myself into, I don't have time to meditate. And that's okay, because I'll just work with what's going to happen today. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that's an excuse, number one. And number two is that setting that intention in the morning for me, just 30 minutes in the morning, it's kind of like tuning your guitar before you sit down and play. You know, if you don't take that time to tune the guitar, you're playing out of key and you don't even hear it. You don't even hear it because you're just focusing on the notes, you know, and doing the right stuff. So the important thing, I think, is getting that moment to tune the guitar and kind of see what your own distractions are. What are you telling yourself? Mm-hmm. What are you getting caught up in inside your own head before you go out there and try to work with what's thrown at you?
Well, you may not always have such opportunities. The important thing is that we make sure that we find points, punctuation points throughout the day. You may not be able to do this until 11 o'clock in the morning, yeah, because you've got a household full of kids,
yep,
or, you know, and stuff like that. So,
right.
But you make sure you give yourself some room somewhere,
right,
to basically stop,
yes,
and just sit. And the posture is critically important, as we talked about. Posture is very important, and because the posture helps to support the whole process of seeing clearly and relaxing deeply. And so, you know, it's not just throwing yourself on the couch and going, all right, I'm going to meditate. Yes.
Back to that emptiness thing. That gap.
Yes.
That gap is emptiness.
Yes. That's the first peek at it.
And has anybody experienced prolonged emptiness, or is it impossible to even say that?
Nobody's experienced
that. You experience that in meditation.
Beyond experience. We can familiarize ourselves with the space.
Right.
But it isn't like we are experiencing emptiness.
Yeah, and we've said this before. As soon as we do, then it's
fine. Right.
Yeah,
it's a label.
That's right. As soon as
thing.
We do.
Reference
as soon as
point.
You live,
I got a reference point.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's
I want that thing again. That's going to call emptiness.
So, I mean, basically, so you're speaking about it more like in a kind of user-friendly way, when we just go, oh, yeah, a little space between the thoughts, that's great. And it's true, we have that to begin with and work with, and we always have that to work with. But really what the deal is, the big deal, is groundlessness.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, yeah, nothing is supporting this at all. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, our friend here, Carl the Guttakara, he's talking about groundlessness is the source of panic, but it's also the source of liberation. You know, so it's the same point. This groundlessness, which everybody is realizing, the grass is moving underneath us. I mean, this is becoming more and more apparent right now today.
Yes.
In our today's society, mm-hmm. and craziness and uncertainty and all these eternal truths we took for granted for so long are just going right out the door. What happened, you know? And so here we are, right? This has been going on before Trump was elected by a long shot.
Wait, emptiness didn't just start now?
Groundlessness.
But the sutra also says that the Buddha abides in the emptiness.
Say that again.
It's not just there are only flashes of it.
The Buddha abides.
Well, the Buddha is completely established in the absolute nature, completely inseparable from that. And that's how we need to understand Buddha mind.
Right.
The Buddha is not somebody out there sitting on a mountaintop or some kind of replication of somebody who lived 2,500 years ago. It's Buddha mind. It's our own basic ultimate sanity. And so that's the most important thing to understand. We need to understand that Buddha nature is our own true nature. This is what we're working at. This is why it's worth engaging with this as a real, with some actual passion, I have to say.
I'm curious to hear how people feel about that statement. Like, do you feel that's sort of a fantasy, Buddha nature? Or do you feel there's possibility there?
Potential.
If the way it's phrased feels like it's opposites, right? So you're passionately attached to having Buddha mind. Do you know what I mean?
It's not like that. There's something else that starts to take place. We have a desire nature. Everything we do is based on wish. We want this, we want that. Our hopes and fears are all based on being in this desire realm. We are complete creatures of desire. So we can use this energy positively to direct it. We can make use of our wish.
Yeah.
Very strong power. It's an extraordinary power, if you'll notice. It's driving the whole world around one way or another. You know, whether it's sex, okay, materialism, you know, whatever else we want to talk about, I got to achieve something, you know, I have to stay healthy, you know, it's all passion. I want, I want, I want. So the want is not going to disappear, and there's no reason on earth to try to squelch it. Let's put it to work for us. We can actually direct our mind to direct our mind as a wish towards fundamentally waking up and recognizing. And this is the only way we're going to be able to be open to it unawares, as it were, when it just happens spontaneously. And it will. It's not only something that's deliberately achieved. There are a lot of other things that happen. But on the other hand, if we don't build up a way of life that will support that, there's no way we can actually maintain ourselves. So, you know, this is part of the thing. We are in a body. We have issues that come up in our body, and it's a very impermanent proposition. At the same time, we have the opportunity and the capacity to actually develop a way of life that will actually support this kind of reality to come through. And that's actually the key point. So use our passion, and we call that devotion in Buddhism, actually. Mm-hmm. That's what the meaning of devotion is. It's fundamental willingness to really direct our heart towards what we really understand to be the truth, and we want to be in the truth, and we want to be the truth. We want to live it. And so this is the key. And so we have our own desire nature to help us along with this, to supply the juice, you know. I mean, it's like the gasoline that's in the motor driving you along, making everything cook. So, so that's critical. you know, and then he talks about what we see, or what do we see, what we think we see, versus other species who have sentience as well, sentient perceptions. I mean, we think this is it. You know, the way we perceive these walls, doors, clouds, trees, everything else, it's all of course, this is just how it is. But it's only really, we've only agreed that it happens to be that way, because actually, there are, ask any other animal who operates and has sentience, and they would tell you something very different about what they see.
A little ant growing across the floor. Yeah. I don't think they pick up on that.
No. So, and then we have quantum physics and science to help us understand that fundamentally all we see are basically energy patterns. And, you know, and actually, you know, people come to this point of understanding that what we're seeing and what we think is there is just a probability. But it's actually, we've talked about this consensus reality before, how it's just a series of agreements that allow us to actually communicate with each other. And we decide that those things are real, but actually, it's just how we use to communicate. It's not like real, real. Because if it's real, then it has to have certain characteristics or qualifications, and nobody's been able to come up with that very well. So the one thing, however, is that, you know, as we utilize science to help understand and support this exploration of the nature of things, we discover that fundamentally everything is space. I mean, if we go into physics, you know, we actually look at what the actual structure of an atom is. And not, it's, you know, it's got one little figment of something that seems to be moving around in an indeterminate manner, and everything else is space. So, you know, this is very interesting because it helps us open up to the fact that this is not just an intellectual or any kind of just philosophical point we're looking at. Actually, it has to do with an integral kind of aspect of body, speech, and mind. It's all pervasive. So, you know, this is great on some level, because then we realize I'm not just dealing with some kind of, you know, really far-out, exotic interpretation of reality, which is very helpful. So, let's see. Well, we don't have a lot of time left, but I will just touch on this thing called fourfold emptiness. Did anybody read about that? Did that ring a bell to anybody? Fourfold emptiness. Now, we only have one text we're looking at to think about fourfold emptiness, and that is the Heart Sutra itself. We're not bringing in some other reference. I guess we didn't read. Okay. That's very interesting. Fourfold emptiness. Form is emptiness. Emptiness also is form. Emptiness is no other than form. Form is no other than emptiness. Fourfold emptiness, okay? Mm-hmm. So, are form and emptiness the same? Any idea?
Yes.
You got a
yes down.
According
there.
To that, fourfold emptiness,
I
would say
how?
Yes.
There's
not, it can't be separate.
How is it empty? How is form empty?
The Buddha told us it is.
Oh, that's great.
No, proof by authority.
Proof by authority.
So, let's explain what this means, because this is critical.
Yes.
We don't want to just endlessly repeat this mantra, you know, gate, gate, paragate, bodhisvaha, parasangate. I mean, no, it's not the answer. The answer is to look at what it is. So the understanding of this is that the essence or nature of form is empty. That's what it means.
That okay? It's not solid?
Hmm?
That it's not solid? The solidity of it is not solid.
It's not solid.
It's not solid.
Not solid because it has, it just basically its own nature is emptiness. In other words, we slap names on it and then we say, oh, it's real because I just gave it a name. That's the fourth of the nidanas. We were studying nidanas, remember? Stages of becoming. We get in a name and form and bingo. Everything starts to get more and more solid, and the next thing you know is like, it's like a Sherman tank coming at you, right? So, okay, essence. And so, how is emptiness formed?
Well,
Well, the answer is simple, because there's nothing but emptiness. So form is emptiness. I mean, admittedly, this is a little bit of a play of words, but it's a way to start to look at things. If we actually start to shift our way of seeing this, it's not going to be so hard to work with.
I think this is good. I'd like to read this part. So this on page 100.
Uh-huh.
So this is about the fourfold profundity.
Mm-hmm.
What this passage talks about is the unity of the two realities, with form representing seeming or relative reality and emptiness ultimate reality. Why is form empty? Because it is empty of a nature of its own. Why is emptiness form? Because it is nothing but emptiness that appears as form.
So we've been prefacing earlier the notion of relative truth and absolute truth. Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When we talked about, this is absolutely important to understand when we're going into this. Relative truth is what we accept as given to work with. We have to work with each other. We use words and so on. And that's all good. I'm not like saying something's wrong with that. But it's not absolute. In other words, this is a provisional kind of thing that's going on. It's useful, but it's just basically provisional. Whereas the absolute is beyond definition or beyond conditions. It's not determined by conditions. Mm-hmm. So the unconditioned nature is simply beyond. You just have to open yourself up to this. And I think if you actually are willing to work with your thoughts and your experience and practice, it will help. But the other thing is, of course, reciting this sutra is very helpful. In my experience, I will just speak for myself, because I've been reciting this thing for the last 35 or 40 years. And, you know, at first I just did it, and at a certain point it started to sink in. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not like, this is kind of a right brain thing. It's kind of intuitive. It's not deductive. You're not going to get it by thinking through it. You know, I mean, although Brunhilde is giving us lots of things to think about, mm-hmm. and ways of understanding this, actually, our perception is the key point. And so the prajna, which is our own capacity to see the nature of emptiness, because prajna is actually what sees emptiness. That's really important.
That's very important.
And so we have that in us. It's not just some kind of great wisdom that is only reserved for high-level bodhisattvas. It is actually something we actually have in us. And so our path is to start to develop and cultivate prajna, utilizing our awareness, our discrimination, our capacity to see for ourselves what, you know, this truth is. It emerges out of continuing to look. And I think that's a key point, is not being afraid of being curious, not being afraid to continue to explore, and not being satisfied with no, because I can't figure it out. You're not going to figure it out.
Yeah, you're Emily was trying to get through all four of them.
Yeah, all right. So I know, but I mean,
whenever you can get through.
Maybe we'll get there, maybe we won't. The most important thing is we actually understand one point, if we can. They say, if something liberates one, it liberates all.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to this has to do with the notion of this empty nature.
Mm-hmm.
That the empty nature itself, if we actually understand the nature of things to be empty, then we begin to understand that they are already liberated in themselves. This makes a great deal of difference as we encounter problems.
Can I read just one more thing here?
Yeah.
Once things interact, such as functioning as causes and the results, they become dependent on other things. That is why Nagarjuna said that it is precisely because of emptiness that things appear and function.
Right.
It is precisely because phenomena are not solid and independent that they can change. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, everything is completely static and frozen. So it's because of their emptiness that they have that interactivity. They can only exist according to their interdependence with other things.
That's one aspect of emptiness, what we call independent origination.
Mm-hmm.
Interdependent origination.
Right.
Yeah, everything is fundamentally... So that's one aspect of understanding emptiness, of understanding the nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we can also understand emptiness as we go further into this, and you go further into prajnaparamita, literature, it's talked about the mother of all phenomena. So it's the matrix which gives rise to everything at the same time. Everything's coming out of emptiness. Okay? Mm-hmm. So in other words, it's like this, and it's often given feminine characteristics because of that. Mm-hmm. So we talk about feminine as prajna and skillful means as masculine. Skillful means upaya, that's learning how to cope and work with things and finding appropriate means to do things. But the perception itself is actually considered the feminine. So shunyata or emptiness is considered feminine. And it's wonderful because it's so spacious and accommodating. It's ultimately accommodating. I mean, you know, I don't want to use the word. It's not because it's making room for things. It's beyond that. It's all pervasive. So we're talking about something that's pretty close to absolute. That's why we talk about absolute and relative bodhicitta. When we talk about absolute bodhicitta, and we were instructed, I can't remember if everyone was here when we gave those initial instructions, is to, let's do that. Mm-hmm. Sit up straight. That's good posture. Look directly out. And just flash on now. Open. Okay, so, you know, thoughts are going to start crawling in again. We know that. No problem. But just that flash is kind of just that. We all have that. It's all right. It's here already. That's the most important point. I know we're not going to be able to go much beyond where we are right now. But can we take a question or two right now specific to what has been discussed if we need? So I don't want to leave people in the lurch.
We are in the lurch. Yeah, let's face it. Right. It's groundless.
Is it fair enough to say that these different words just attempt to somehow deal with emptiness? That is, if you substitute the word that you use for emptiness for, and if you're just to say, well, you know, you every time you use the word emptiness, use form, it's still the...
Well, I think we have... We want to basically work with definitions that sort of... If we just try to switch things around adventitiously, you know, by just, like, throw the dice, it doesn't make too much sense. Emptiness is not a really adequate word to be using. I think eventually, you know... English language is going to take in this word shunya or shunyata because it actually expresses more than... Well, one of the things Brentholzer sort of talks about is how many things we can think of, like a vacuum or something, that if we get rid of something, then it'll be empty. You know, that's not what it's about at all. We have to dissociate and learn how to explore emptiness in terms of openness. It's really openness is a closer. I don't know if you know who Herbert Günther was. He was a very famous Tibet... He was a philosopher and Tibetologist, and you know, he described openness as being a more adequate approximation of the word shunyata. In Tibet, it's called tongpanyi. Basically, it's just because we know that English does not have every single understanding of every. I mean, this is the factor of just a tradition that's been developed a couple of thousand years.
It hasn't been in our culture. So
right, exactly. No, but I just like we find we can now use terms like samsara and nirvana without too much of an issue. Probably going to end up shunyata will probably be a term.
I just want to point people when you go home to look at page 13 in the introduction, because it's. I think this is so brilliant about the meaning of emptiness, and that's just what you were saying. Zero, it talks about shunya is empty. And another meaning is zero. Mm. And shunya or zero means fullness, completeness, or wholeness. Mm. In the same way, emptiness does not mean nothingness, but rather fullness in the sense of full potential. Anything can happen in emptiness and because of emptiness. So I think that's really important way to understand.
And that's also the way we can understand the source of compassion, how emptiness and compassion are not separate. That's why they are never separate. you know, it's not like an intellectual exercise. The compassion is basically intrinsic to emptiness, because when we have an open heart, we are capable of responding mm-hmm. to situations and people in a way very differently than just going through in some kind of analysis and trying to, you know, deductive reasoning to break it down. So we have this open heart. And remember, again, there's never going to be any point in giving up on repeating this. This is mind.
Right.
In mind. Buddhism. Mind is here, not up here. We have what we call heart-mind, and we employ the brain and all of its functions. But mind, the core of mind, is here in the heart. That's a much easier way to understand how what we're really working with.
Right.
Essence.
Okay, so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's much easier to understand essence that way. Heart is closer to essence, mm-hmm. isn't it? Okay. Thank you very much.